diversity, diversity, diversity.
Here, that cause confusion.
How precious, moron.
Have you got a large one?
I've had no complaints so far.
Seeing's believing.
You won't need a magnifying glass.
Ooh.
Here we are. No. Have it on me. You know what I mean?
Oh. You don't have to draw me any diagrams.
Pity. She's going to get my ballpoint out.
Yeah, and write your name in the froth with it, I suppose. Bottoms up.
Is that what it is? You could have fooled me.
The Carry On series of films are a much-beloved part of British culture, spanning 30 films in 20 years, from 1958 to 1978, or if we must include the 1992 abomination Carry On Columbus, which I suppose we must, 31 films in 34 years. To give you an idea of how popular these films are and were, in 1979, Carry On Doctor aired on the BBC. It garnered a television audience of 20.6 million. That means that approximately 37% of the nation watched the film together that night. And this was not just a one-off. For example, in 1978, just a year earlier, an airing of Carry On Abroad got over 18 million. These are typical numbers. If you were to widen the scope to include anyone who'd ever watched a Carry On film on TV in this country, I would guess the figure would be closer to 80%. If you took away certain under-30s these days, who have never seen a television, and of course recent arrivals, the number is likely close to 100%. These films are an excellent example of what I've been calling vernacular popular British culture, which was watched by millions of people, did not travel much far outside these blessed isles, was generally disdained and looked down upon by the establishment, distinctly low-brow, at times bawdy, happy to trade in cliché and stereotypes, repetitive and stubborn in sticking to its tried and tested formulas. But as I've said, in vernacular culture, the familiar is comforting. People do not want novelty or innovation or the exotic, but that which confirms them securely in their own identity. It is not high art made to scale the heights, but peasant fare for the crowd, for the ordinary folk, to help them cope with life. There is no reason not to celebrate this as being as much as part of the culture as, say, Edward Elgar. And in this video, I'm going to provide as comprehensive a guide as I can manage. As Stephen Lamb put it, the Carry On films are as much part of British culture as warm beer and fish and chips. They draw from a deep well of older vernacular popular British culture, such as the 1930s music hall act Max Miller, known as the Cheeky Chappie, the saucy seaside postcards of Donald McGill, and even the Beano and the Dandy. Leon Hunt, in his book Low British Culture, written in 1998, suggested that there is something authentic in the fact that the makers of good taste simply cannot appropriate low culture, and anything they have to say about it, especially in the case of these films, automatically seems ridiculous. Let me quote the passage in full. He says, "If certain popular forms are admitted into the canon, another way of valuing the low is precisely through its resistance to rehabilitation, often embodied in the search for a final textual frontier that exists beyond the colonising powers of the Academy. If I had to think of one reason why the carry-ons matter so much, writes Andy Medhurst, it's because they aren't really recuperable for proper culture. The same desire for a good bad object seems evident in Peter Hutchins' fear that rendering Hammer horror films worthy and respectable would be doing them a disservice. More, it would be like forcing them into the light and watching helplessly as they crumble into dust. Right, enough of all that. There is quite a lot to get through here, and I am determined to get through it, even if it takes over an hour. So I have devised these contents. I should say that I do not have time to get into the various goings-on of the eventful and often tragic private lives of the stars of these films beyond a very quick York Notes version. Kenneth Williams was a great enigma, closeted yet very obviously gay, private yet desperate for attention, whose last diary entry before a possible suicide, aged 62, it was an overdose, was, "Oh, what's the bloody point?" Sid James had an affair with Barbara Windsor, but was apparently a nice guy, and not as womanising as his reputation suggested. Charles Hawtrey was close to his mother and a terrible alcoholic. Hattie Jake struggled with her weight and health and was married to John Le Mesurier of Dad's Army fame, who was also a drunk. And Jake's had many an affair, sometimes even sleeping with men while her husband was in the house. Pretty dark. Joan Sims never married, suffered from depression, and later also, as many of the other of the cast did, had drink problems. I am not much interested in this gossipy side of things. Not because it is not interesting in and of itself. I have to admit it is all sufficiently dark enough that it is. But rather because there is so much of this out there already, including TV dramatisations and whatnot, that it would be redundant for me to linger on all this. What I want to provide in this video is things that you are less likely to know in a level of detail hitherto unimagined. So first, I shall establish some basic facts about the Carry On series, and we shall meet the principal men responsible for these films, which is to say the producer, the director, and the writers. Second, I will delve into the budget data of each film, as I have in an internet first, painstakingly adjusted the budgets for inflation so we can ascertain what was the cheapest and most expensive of these films. Third, we shall meet the key regulars who make up the ensemble cast. I will also explain something of the recurring hierarchies and structures that we see as they fall into their various roles. Fourth, I will outline the eras of the Carry On films and explain how they changed and developed over time. And fifth and finally, I have in another internet first collated a critical consensus score out of 5 for every film using ratings given by some of the writers of the excellent resources available on these films. I will also perhaps give my own idiosyncratic ranking while acknowledging that my tastes can be a little peculiar. On that score, before continuing to live up to my name, let me share the 10 books I have consulted to make this video. I should mention that the bibliography on these films is surprisingly vast, and there are tons more books out there that I did not consult, some pretty highly rated ones too, including an academic monograph or two, and the published diaries of Kenneth Williams, which are fascinating in and of themselves. So these are the 10 books. I won't, you know, you can see them on the screen there. I won't read them all out. Of these, Campbell, Lamb, and Robert Ross provide our star ratings. Snellgrove and Weber are content to confine themselves to facts and anecdotes, while Frost and Fryer seem to have pretensions to literary analysis. I will just mention in passing that Robert Ross's Carry On Companion has the most random foreword perhaps in publishing history. It is provided by none other than Phil Collins. I wonder what the genesis of that was. Anyway, let's carry on. Oh, and on that score, for the remainder of this video, I will omit the carry on part of the film titles, mainly so I don't keep on saying carry on, which I've already said four times in this paragraph. The two central figures behind the Carry On franchise were Peter Rogers, the producer, and Gerald Thomas, the director. Both had served in the army during World War II, and Thomas had been a prisoner of war, something he shared with Kenneth Connor, Peter Butterworth, and the writer Talbot Rothwell. The fact these films were made by ex-army men is not often commented upon.
I think one of the greatest elements in the whole thing, it's almost like metabolism,
yes,
was that we were all ex-servicemen fairly recently, if you understand me.
Oh, I see.
We all left the Army and Navy about 46. These were done 10 years later.
I suppose some having been in the entertainment side, ENSA and CSE and so on, which came afterwards, didn't it? CSE?
Oh, yes, and military shows, of course, done for ourselves.
Yeah.
We'd love those.
Perhaps it is fitting, then, that the first film, Sergeant, had a military theme. When that was made in 1958, both Rogers and Thomas were already experienced filmmakers. Rogers, 44 years old, had a scriptwriting background, while Thomas, 38 years old, had an editing background. They had made a few children's films together in the mid-1950s. Peter Rogers was a producer for the company Anglo Amalgamated, run by Nat Cohen and Stuart Levy. When an unwanted script based on the play The Bull Boys by R.F. Delderfield, about the experiences of a group of British Army recruits under national service, came his way, Rogers tried to find a comedy writer to turn it into something usable. He looked to many of the biggest names of the era, Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, known for writing The Amazing Steptoe and Son as well as Hancock's Half Hour, Spike Milligan, Eric Sykes, but they all turned him down. At last he found a capable writer under contract at Pinewood Studios right under his nose. This was Norman Hudis, who would go on to write the first six Carry On films. More on him in a moment. Incidentally, every single Carry On film was produced at the legendary Pinewood Studios, and Peter Rogers still had an office there until he died in 2009, aged 95. The Carry On name was suggested because a previous film, unconnected to the series in every way, except for the fact that Joan Sims had a small role in it, had been a minor hit, Carry On Admiral, which incidentally stars another all-time AA hero, David Tomlinson, of Mary Poppins fame.
Hello, I'm Peter Rogers. You're about to see the last of the 1970s carry-on specials we made for television. It's a bit historical and hopefully a bit hysterical. I hope you like it.
The main thing to know about Peter Rogers as a producer is that he was tight. Tight with budgets, tight with pay. He wanted to prove to the film world that films with very low budgets could still turn a good profit, and he proved this many times over with the Carry On films. Part of the low cost of the films was that all of the cast were paid a flat fee, the highest being £5,000 for the top stars. And the lowest, well, Jack Douglas got paid £25 for his role as Twitching Father in Matron. Now, this would be a bone of contention for many of the stars over time, who never received percentages or residuals, but this was the Rogers business model. To give you an idea, in today's money, £5,000 in 1965 works out at around £82,000 today. Well, that's good in general, but in actors' salary terms, it is nothing. Incidentally, we have all the pay data across all of the films. You can see that William Hartnell, better known as the first of Doctor Who, received only £2,000 for his star billing in Sargent. Incidentally, he'd also starred in the Bolting Brothers satire, Private's Progress, 2 years previously, which is perhaps why he was cast. You can see that Kenneth Williams had to work his way up to the £5,000 he received in Cruising. His earliest roles in the series were paid as little as £450. But from Cruising in 1962, he wouldn't get another pay rise until 1978, and that was his last film. I don't know if Kenneth was aware of inflation, but in real terms, the £5,000 he got for Screaming in 1965 was worth twice as much as the £5,000 he got for Behind in 1975, which means he'd taken a 50% real terms pay cut in 10 years.
Infamy! Infamy! They've all got it in for me!
Anyway, you'll notice that Charles Hawtrey is not in Cruising, and that is because he asked for a pay rise and star billing, and Rogers promptly dropped him. He had a philosophy that no one was bigger than the carry-on name. There were no stars above the title, so to speak, and everyone had to work to the budget. Hawtrey did return, and he did get a very slight pay rise from £2,500 to £3,000, but the lesson was learned. Looking across all these wages, considering how much he did for the series, I think Joan Sims would have every right to feel a little diddled. She never got more than the £3,000 she received for Up the Jungle. Also interesting is that on two of the occasions when Sid James, who nearly always got £5,000 as the lead, by the way, Harry H. Corbett, better known as Harold Steptoe, got £12,000 for Screaming, and Phil Silvers, better known as Sergeant Bilko, got a whopping great £30,000 for Follow That Camel. I noticed that I misspoke earlier, as Williams got £6,000 on that occasion, probably because there was a rumour that Silvers was getting paid more. All this suggests that Rogers certainly could have paid all the stars more, but this penny-pinching attitude is part and parcel of making films on a shoestring. In 1972, when the cast turned up for Carry On Abroad, some of them were ready for a trip somewhere, Spain perhaps, only to find that the entire film was shot in the car park of Pinewood Studios. The furthest flung the series ever got for the exotic Up the Khyber was Snowdon, Wales, one of the very few times they shot on location. The Sahara Desert in Follow That Camel were just some sand dunes in East Sussex. The plains in Cowboy were Cobham Common. In a sense, it is remarkable how varied the series feels and what a sense of location each film has given these limitations. Rogers was also quick to seize opportunities, most famously the costumes and sets from the lavish production of Cleopatra, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, which was a £30 million plus budget film, were repurposed for Cleo, which was a £194,000 film. Rogers also wanted a show that films could be made quickly and come in on time. And this is chiefly where Gerald Thomas, the director, came in. Rogers would largely confine himself to casting, budgeting, and making edits to the script. It was up to Thomas to shoot it on schedule and preferably under budget, something he did with great reliability.
It's Gerald Thomas. Well, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Let's start with you. I mean, why on earth bring them back after 10 years? I mean, they were magic at the time, but haven't things rather moved on?
Well, they have, but really we're bringing them back more or less by public demand. We've had an enormous amount of pressure and correspondence in the last 6 months.
But are they still going to be the same? Is it still going to be some tits and bums and innuendos? And...
Yes, maybe bums and tits instead, but it's going to be the same, yes.
Thomas was able to edit in his head, and this sped up the shooting process. There was to be no improvisation on set beyond rehearsals. The actors had to stick to the script with minimal ad hoc additions. Of course, most of the cast had their various shticks, and Thomas gave them quite free rein to interpret their roles as they saw fit. In this way, Thomas got most things shot in one or two takes. This was especially important as some of the bit part actors were paid by the day, and so they didn't want them in a second or a third day if they could help it. Each carry-on film was made in a tight 6-week schedule. All the actors were busy. They had stage commitments in the summer. Some of them had pantomime season at Christmas. Some of them had TV commitments. So carry-on films were shot typically in the spring and in the autumn. They generally kept a pace of 2 films a year, but sometimes they managed only one, and sometimes they somehow squeezed 3 out in 1 year, such as in 1964 and in 1967.
Nora.
Actually, I was just reaching across then, Kenneth, to show them the carry-on movie video, which is about to come out. They're making they're going to release a lot of the videos, aren't they? A lot
yes,
of the carry-on
yes.
videos.
Thousands of them, I believe.
Yes. Well, I hope they sell thousands anyway. Mm. Anyway, that one's carry-on nurse, but they must have been fun to make, mustn't they?
Yes. 6 weeks every year we'd meet. They were done in 6 weeks, you know.
6 weeks?
Oh,
You're
yes.
telling me they made them in 6 weeks?
Yes. We had a race 1 year, I remember, with an Oscar Wilde film. I forget whether it was Peter Finch or Robert Morley in it, but they also did that film in 5 or 6 weeks.
Incredible.
It is safe to say that Thomas was not an auteur, not a flair director, no strange camera angles, jump cuts or any of that. As Stephen Lamb put it, not for him the sweeping panning shot, the adventurous angles, and the intense directed performance. By all accounts, he was an affable and avuncular figure on set, despite his tight schedule. He could have a laugh or enjoy a practical joke, and with big characters like Kenneth Williams, Sid James, Kenneth Connor, Charles Hawtrey, etc. around, it would have been bad for team spirit if he did not let them have a mess around sometimes. But when it was time to work, Thomas's first assistant would come to the floor, clap, and say, "Right, chaps, be loyal." And as soon as he said that, all the fooling around stopped and everyone was ready for the job. Additionally, no one could be late for set. Shooting started promptly at 8:30 a.m. and finished promptly at 5:30 p.m. on the dot. Not a minute overtime for any of the crew. All of that is according to the director of photography, Alan Hume, who was later DOP on such films as Return of the Jedi and Octopussy. He claims that the carry-on schedules were the tightest and most efficient anyone had ever seen in movies. If Thomas excelled in any area beyond his perfunctory and workmanlike efficiency and creating a nice family atmosphere on set, it was in his attention to detail as regards setting and location. While the films are generally shot without much savoir-faire, I think Thomas is generally underrated for his ability to capture a certain mood. Henry, for example, feels very period, not just because of the costume, but the film feels like it's full of scheming courtiers. Don't Lose Your Head is genuinely evocative of the French Revolution. Jack is remarkably period, to the extent that you forget it is a carry-on movie sometimes, when you consider it was made in the same year as the noirish Spying, and consider that Thomas directed both films. It is a testament to his ability to convey mood. But it is not just those bigger, canvas-wide examples either. It is little scenes too, like this one in the otherwise contemporary Loving, where we take a momentary wander into what feels like a Victorian horror film.
Afternoon.
Now, rounding out the key trio of creatives at the heart of the franchise is the screenwriter, of which there are two main writers for the series. Norman Hudis, who wrote the first six Carry On films, and then the incomparable Talbot Rothwell, also known as Tolly, who, like Thomas and the actors Peter Butterworth and Kenneth Connor, had been a prisoner of war in World War II at the Stalag Luft III camp.
Talbot Rothwell. Well, Charlie, we've got some pictures of the production you lot put on in Stalag Luft III, and it looks as though you had things pretty well organised.
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, I think we had one production about every 7 to 10 days, which ran for about 4 or 5 days, I think.
Yes, a long run that was.
Now, even if Pete... there was a long run, yeah. Even if Pete wasn't in them, which was most unlikely, because he's an absolute hog for Perth.
Never.
Well, let's face it, we had a captive audience. But I must say, if he wasn't taking part, he was either designing sets, which he's extremely good at, in fact, he's a very good artist, or mending the theatre, or repairing the seating in the theatre.
Yes.
Even if the people were still in them.
He wrote every Carry On, from Cabby in 1963 to Dick in 1974. 20 straight films, when he suffered some sort of nervous breakdown through being overworked. He got paid £5,000 per script too, by the way, and his attempts to get a percentage cut of the films was rebuffed by Rogers, and we actually have some interesting letter exchanges between the two of them where Rothwell, after being rebuffed, is quite apologetic and embarrassed by the actions of his agent. It's all quite interesting to read. But anyway, when most people think of what a Carry-On movie is, it is generally the Talbot Rothwell penned films they are thinking about. I think it's easiest to understand both writers, Hudis and Rothwell, by way of contrast. The early Carry-On films by Hudis have a little more drama in them, more character development, and are markedly more sentimental and even feel-good, with all that that phrase connotes. The typical setup is that a set of new recruits, whether soldiers in the army and sergeant, patients in a hospital in nurse, teachers to a school in teacher, bobbies on the beat in constable, or shipmates on a crew in cruising, from disparate backgrounds, initially struggle to get on and struggle with some authority figure. But in the end, they pull together, work as a team, and come to realise the authority figure is not so bad after all. The only Hudis penned film that does not follow this formula is Regardless, which is more of an experiment in doing a sketch film and is more of a portmanteau, with a crew doing various odd jobs in a variety of locations with a set of tenuous links back at the office. But generally, you can see these early films have a kind of post-war, all-in-it-together, mucking-in type spirit, the Blitz and all of that, cutting across class boundaries, and they are all set quite fondly in British institutions, which are mildly poked fun at, but then ultimately the films work to reinforce them. The characters are sort of real people with normal names. There are fewer gags and innuendos. There is more slapstick. And there are times when the films aim to pull at our heartstrings. When Rothwell comes in, after the initial three, Cabby, Jack Spying, and even, to some extent, Cowboy, which are transitional and a little different, I'll talk more about that in a bit, they're more plot-heavy, more character-driven, from Cleo in 1964 to Dick in 1974, Rothwell developed a style that leaned away from the plot being important, ramped up the number of gags, corny jokes, silly Dickensian names, double entendres and innuendos, made the comedy less slapstick, more bawdy, somehow broader. Sometimes you laugh when you realise there are no depths Rothwell will not mine for a one-liner.
Young chickens may be soft and tender, but the older birds have more on them.
True. It'll take a lot more stuffing.
Sometimes you laugh because an innuendo is implied even when no part of it makes any sense.
Please, Miss Plunkett, you're squashing my itinerary.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I keep forgetting what a big girl I am now.
Quite. Shall we get them out now?
Why, Mr. Farquhar?
The people for the coach, I mean.
Those. Yes, of course.
I mean, no part of that made any sense. Squashing my itinerary, indeed. The jokes in these films are one case where something is so bad it wraps around space and time, comes out the other end to be something wonderful. The more groany, the groaner, the better. The world of Rothwell's films are less innocent than Hudis's. More will-weary, more cynical. Men are driven by lust and greed. Women are aware of themselves as a commodity in the sexual marketplace and work to maximise what they can get out of it. Towards the end, the sexual frustration of the middle-aged man reaches almost fever dream status.
Take it still.
Mac, the back pocket!
Didn't you say so? There. Now, come along and stop making such an exhibition of yourself.
While Hudis works towards a kind of feel-good, tear-jerker ending, Rothwell might work towards a gag punchline. For example, and sorry, this is spoilers, people, so cover your eyes and cover your ears. Henry ends with Williams as Thomas Cromwell and Terry Scott as Cardinal Wolsey opting for the executioner's axe rather than endure trying to get the king another divorce. Or the films can end by descending into chaos where there's a knees up or perhaps a fight, but generally the crescendo is a kind of anarchy, a dissolving in of the plot on itself. Rothwell is always non-sentimental, and while he's generally viewed as a right-wing writer, at the very least, small-c conservative, in some cases outright reactionary, Hudis, by the way, is seen as more liberal and progressive, but nonetheless, there is something quite radical in the fact that most, if not all, pomposity is punctured, undermined, or otherwise sent up in these films. Rothwell was said to have some rules for his writing. No one would ever actually swear, and despite the, at times, insane levels of seediness on display, none of the men ever succeeded in actually getting their leg over. There is something increasingly pathetic about the dirty old men who populate his scripts. I will speak more on this later, but the level of sexual repression is at times utterly tragic. I especially feel this about Kenneth Connor's middle-aged men when he comes back to the series.
Well, I for one think it is absolutely outrageous asking us to share a room just because we're married.
I don't know, dear. I mean, I thought it was quite reasonable in the circumstances. Oh, that's a jolly good idea. Huh?
Well?
Yes, well, I'll just go out onto the balcony.
And don't forget to keep looking the other way.
For now, I will just say that I think while Rogers and Thomas provided the structure and the cast provided an extremely talented ensemble of very well-defined characters to draw from, if there's an artistic talent anywhere in these films, it is in Rothwell. I have often seen it written that the cast do well despite the script. That really, these films are all about how the actors deal with ropey material. I disagree with this assessment largely, and believe that almost everything people love about these films comes from the pen and imagination of Rothwell. We see films with the same cast, the same director, and the same producer before Rothwell and after Rothwell, and the magic is only really there when he is writing. And although the first script of his, Cabby, is one of the very best films in the series objectively, I do not think he hits on his signature style until he's about four or five films in. It's from Cleo onwards, really, and I would argue, perhaps controversially, that we don't get the definitive Rothwell until about 1969, from Camping onwards, but more on that later. Now, before we delve into the films and the cast more as promised, let us have a look at these budgets. Here I have inflation-adjusted all of the budgets to be expressed in constant 1968 British pound sterling. 1968 is the median of all of the years, the exact middle point of the 20 years of the film, so that's why I've chosen 1968. We can see that Follow That Camel in 1967 was the most expensive film overall. Probably that was the salary of Phil Silvers that did that. But the general pattern is of rise and fall. The films start out very cheap in the Hoodis era. We have a rising cost as the series peaks in popularity during the 1960s, and then a general falling in the 1970s as the series itself dwindled. In many ways, this is exactly what one would expect. The average cost of a film in 1968 pounds was just £166,562, or in today's money, that's just over £3.6 million. All 30 films were made for just under £5 million in 1968 money, or just over £108 million in today's money. So there we have it in hard data. Rogers really did keep a very tight ship. Now let's meet the cast, and more importantly, the typical structures of the social worlds of these films. The lead star of most Carry On films is Sid James, a lovable rogue with his signature yak 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 laugh.
Stay here, I'll thank you when it's over.
It's ridiculous.
Now I think James is generally underrated in how well he carries a lot of these films. And in many different settings and locations too. He's a very good leading man. When he's missing, you tend to notice it quite a lot. Generally, Sid is married to a battle axe, and most often it is Joan Sims, but sometimes it is Hattie Jakes. In either case, she is liable to hit him with an umbrella or similar for his leering at younger women. There's generally one younger woman, typically Barbara Windsor, but sometimes it's Liz Fraser, sometimes it's Angela Douglas, who Sid has the hots for, much to his wife's chagrin. Very occasionally, when the wife is Hattie Jakes, the younger woman is Joan Sims, making an interesting hierarchy in the Carry On women, with Jakes the benchmark fat and unloved, as well as the most battle-axe-ish, Sims the perennial mid, and the younger woman as the apex hotness. Now, regardless of the gender politics of all this, which frankly I do not care about, Sims is an extremely underrated actress who can truly do it all. When she needs to be sexy, she can just about pull it off. When she needs to be frumpy, dour, miserable, whatever, she can do it. But her absolute specialism is the barely contained, seething jealousy and bitterness at being the woman scorned or passed over for the younger woman. I am not sure if any actress, any era or genre, has that down to a T more than Sims. Judging by some of her interviews, which I came across researching for this video, some of this was quite close to the surface for her, because naturally she did not like being cast as the less hot woman. They do say that the best performances have an underlying kernel of truth to them. In most, but not all, Carry On films, Kenneth Williams is generally some sort of authority figure, employing his snooty and haughty aristocratic character.
See Mrs. Moore, sir.
And she... Oh, yes, that's different. It's a rather wealthy private patient of mine. I took an appendix out the other day.
I hope you both had a nice time.
I'll make the jokes, if you don't mind. Stoppage. All right, Fosdick, get the car.
Who can also be cowardly, a hypochondriac, or generally villainous, as the part and the plot demands. However, Williams also has what is known as his snide character, which was developed on the sitcom Hancock's Half Hour, which was more Cockney and the origin of his stop messing about catchphrase. Snide was more liable to say things like you nit and things like that. In later roles, Williams might slide into the snide character for a line or two, but in some earlier roles, like spying, for example, he is in that mode for the whole film.
Oh, thank goodness for that. I thought I'd been filed for life.
What the hell are you doing in there, Simpkins?
You'll never believe it, Chief. Last night I came in here to put some files away, and some stupid, interfering, over-efficient nit went and slammed the door on me.
I was the one who locked up in here last night, Simpkins.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, well, a very good job you made of it, sir, I must say.
Now, you can contrast the two extremes of the snooty character and the snide by watching Spying back-to-back with Jack, in which Williams is absurdly over-the-top, not to mention cowardly, aristocratic captain.
Oh, I don't know, Mr. Harriet. It was quite an understandable mistake, really.
You don't know this man, sir.
You don't know my wife.
Your wife's irrelevant, sir.
Oh, you've noticed that, have you?
No, what I mean is that she has nothing to do with the matter in hand. I mean, well, damn it, sir, he's guilty of insolence and insubordination.
Yes, I suppose you're right. Well, what have you to say for yourself?
Only, sir, that I spoke truly. I am Albert Poopdecker, R.N.
You see, sir? A hopeless liar.
I'm afraid I agree with Mr. Howitt. I flatter myself I'm a just and intelligent man, but look at you. You don't even look like Midshipman Poopdecker.
How would you know what he looks like, sir?
How do I know? I can see him. Look for yourself. You don't look anything like him.
You might just as well say that he doesn't look anything like me.
Quite. I'm glad we agree.
Williams also has a kind of camp, this is the real me character that comes out for a line or two as well, which is a little bit like his version of breaking the fourth wall. Generally, Williams is a kind of antagonist in the films, often a villain, but his role tends to move about as the plot demands. In the early films, the hapless everyman young lover is played by Kenneth Connor, who is full of nervous tics and weird facial expressions.
Sam, are you in some kind of trouble?
The worst.
What's her name?
Oh, please. It's worse than that.
Look, Sam, tell me all about it, and probably all your worries will disappear like a puff of smoke.
Oh,
good gracious me. If you've got a hangover, it must be a real corker. Now, look, take my tip.
Corker and... tip. No, hey, no.
Sam, what on earth is the matter?
I want it. Oh, cigarette, damn it, cigarette.
Connor was also a West End star, so after Cleo in 1964... because of a series of successful runs for him, he was unavailable for a stretch of 5 years, returning in 1970, seemingly a much older man. So when he comes back, he is quite an extraordinary lech. I think I love Connor's sleazy older posh guy. Something very odd about him. But anyway, generally speaking, during his absence, Connor was replaced in the cast by Jim Dale, who would take over the young, slightly nervous everyman characters. I believe that Connor comes back just as Dale leaves after again Doctor. The young lover role is then taken by Julian Holloway. The other big main carry-on regular, Charles Hawtrey, immortalised here by the Smiths, is generally, though not always, more ancillary or to one side of the main action. It's kind of a sideshow, if you want to put it that way. He generally adds to the feeling of anarchy, heightens the campness levels. He's basically a visual reminder that you're watching a carry-on film. His entrances tend to make an impact. His weedy frame and effete manner is also the source of much physical comedy. Other stars tend to round out the gallery of caricatures feel of carry-on. Big Bernard Breslau, the bumpkinish Jack Douglas, the oddball Peter Butterworth, or the smooth face Terry Scott. When beloved British comedy actors, more famous for other things, drop in, such as Bernard Cribbins in Jack and Spying, Harry H. Corbett in Screaming, Frankie Howard in Doctor and Up the Jungle, or even Windsor Davis in Behind in England, less said about those the better, they generally slot in quite well. The only exception is the American Phil Silvers in Follow That Camel, which just does not seem to work for whatever reason.
Too, Sergeant.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Because when I get you out of here, I'm going to make your life so miserable, you're going to be glad to get back in.
Now, with all this established, I can now talk you through the eras of Carry On. I think the films are too often thought of as all being of one piece, when in fact there are distinct periods with some very different characteristics. Here are the 30 films, sans Columbus, which I am loath to acknowledge. I believe I have already established the early Hoodis era and its general characteristics. These films are Sergeant, Nurse, Teacher, Constable, Regardless, and Cruising. As I've mentioned, all have a different feel from most of the other films. They are more conventional kind of film comedy dramas. Tolly Rothwell comes in with the next film, Cabby, which is also different. It was not initially written as a carry-on film, and therefore has more drama and character. It's probably one of the best films of the whole series, viewed as a film, and definitely Hattie Jake's best role, but the feel is different. It's almost British New Cinema or kitchen sink in vibe, despite the silly boys versus girls storyline of the two rival taxi firms. With Jack and Spying, we start the arc of parodies of well-known Hollywood genres. Jack, like Cabby, was not written as a carry-on film. And this, I think, shows quite a lot when you watch it, because there are long periods of the film without any gags and are notably more straight than we'd expect. There's also no Sid. Instead, we get Bernard Cribbins, who's great in the lead, but for a carry-on, this one feels different. But it is chiefly because the carry-on, as we know it and as we think of it, did not yet really exist. As a little trivia titbit, Rothwell wanted to call Jack Up the Armada, but the censors wouldn't have it. This is equally true, by the way, of Spying, a James Bond parody, and the title was registered by Peter Rogers immediately in 1962, when it became clear that Dr. No was a hit. Incidentally, that one also stars Bernard Cribbins. Now, for whatever reason, these first three Rothwell-penned films do not feel like the rest, and I see them all as transitional films from the early Hudis era to what Carry On would become. Cleo is undoubtedly the one where it all clicked and the start of the golden era. Carolyn Frost demarcates it this way in her book. With the exception of Follow That Camel, which has the Silver's problem, and Cowboy, which is an odd film because the entire thing is played in broad American accents and is somewhat straighter than the others, closer in a way to Jack, all of the films of the golden period tend to be the ones that are most fondly remembered by fans of the series, especially Cleo, the Hammer horror parody Screaming, and of course Up the Khyber, which tends to be the one film in the series selected for top 100 film lists, BFI and British Heritage sort of stuff. Doctor is also easily the best of the four medical themed films. I should mention here also that the franchise switched distributors from Anglo Amalgamated to the Rank organization in 1967 with Follow That Camel, and the inclusion of Silvers was to appease the new production company, who had dreams of breaking the series again into America. Carry On Nurse in 1959 had done quite well as well. Now, I would argue that from Camping in 1969, we reach Rothwell's settled style and his late period. The level of sleaze and smuttiness notches up a touch here as the 60s gives way to the 70s, but it is never vulgar. While, again, Doctor, Matron and Up the Jungle are all cash-in sequels of a sort, I really love this later run of films. The cast are all a little bit older. Kenneth Connor comes back as the perviest middle-aged man ever, and Sid is just masterful and world-weary in all of these outings. I generally like it when he's in a cardigan or a tweed suit or something. I think overall, I like it when the Carry On films are just in contemporary Britain. In these later films, everyone just knows what they're doing. The ensemble is close-knit. And these are the ones that I recall, for whatever reason, endlessly being repeated on television. I like the sense of things being routine, that people know their roles by rote, that there is a certain degree of going through the motions. These are the mundane rhythms of everyday life, habit and mundane repetition, like the best of Samuel Beckett's plays. There is something of all of this in the later Carry On films. It captures the clock-in, clock-out, evenly rotating aspect of life. I have a special fondness for the contemporary set ones, Loving, At Your Convenience, Abroad and Girls. These four especially do not get enough love. In a way, these later films are a little overshadowed by the flashier and more colourful Golden Age films, which are all period pieces or parodies. You know, they're colourful, they've got costumes. But the later period has some of that too. Henry is one of the better period pieces. Dick is a nice farewell to Sid. He died shortly after making it. After this, the series basically falls off a cliff. Some people put this down to changing tastes, but the 20 million people who were watching the films repeated on TV in 1979 clearly had not changed their tastes. I put it down to the fact that Talbot Rothwell had a breakdown and was forced to retire due to health issues, and that Sid James died. The series was basically unable to recover from this double whammy. The subsequent writers just could not get the tone right. They were too rude, too on the nose, actual smut rather than innuendo, veering on porn at times. A kind of coarseness and crudeness entirely missing from Rothwell's world. And that is what really did the series in, I think. I have no doubt that if Sid had lived, and if Rothwell had been able to continue writing, that the series would have not had the sorry end that it did. It's not that these last three films are atrocious or anything. Well, they kind of are, but anyway, it is just that the formula has been too badly disrupted and or not well enough understood by the people who are making it. Gerald Thomas was quoted as saying once, basically our pictures are of the same format, the same people, different locales and different incidents that happen, but basically it is a formula which the public expect. Peter Rogers also said, we just made the same film over and over. In short then, behind England and Emmanuel, we're different films, made with different people, and we're not what the public expected. And remember, we're not even going to discuss Columbus. This now brings us finally to the issue of ratings and rankings. I have devised this table to show how Robert Ross, Mark Campbell and Stephen Lamb rate each of the films out of 5, and then the final column gives a mean average score. You'll see that Campbell likes the Who This Era more than the other two. Ross is a little too down on Jack, by his own later admission on the commentary tracks he did for the DVD set. If we then sort the average ratings from highest to lowest, it gives us a final ranking that looks like this. Critical consensus is that Cleo and Up the Khyber are the undisputed masterpieces of the series, followed by Campy, Screaming and Spying. And this largely accords with audience reception in my view. Perhaps Camping looms larger in the cultural memory than Cabby, probably because of the famous bra-popping scene with Barbara Windsor. And Cabby is more of a kind of hidden gem or critical favourite rather than an audience favourite. But generally, I think this list is where most people would be with these films. Now that the science is settled, I can provide my own ranking. As per my comments already, I think the critics, in general, skew too much towards the so-called golden era, and I have a real fondness for the early 1970s, late Rothwell era, where everything is really well worn. This accords with my general idea that artists tend to find themselves most at the end of their careers, rather than in their generally accepted peak periods. I have this view, for example, of late era Bob Dylan. The Dylan of Love and Theft is, to me, the Dylan he always wanted to be, and I think the Rothwell of Carry On Abroad is, in a sense, the Rothwell he always wanted to be. That film being, quite literally, a saucy postcard come to life. As you can see, I have given 8 films the 5-star rating. Now, you must understand that this is a rating relative to the Carry On canon, and not in terms of films overall. Which is to say, I do not think Carry On Girls is something to be ranked alongside Citizen Kane. In general, I think that almost everything should be rated on its own terms rather than in some arbitrary universal. So my favourites are Cabby, which has, like I said, that real early 1960s kitchen sink vibe. Hits different, as the kids say. Cleo, Screaming and Khyber. Those three being the objective, critical and commercial high points of the series. And then Loving, At Your Convenience, Abroad and Girls as my early 1970s guilty pleasures. I also think that these films find Rothwell at his most reactionary, lampooning unions in At Your Convenience, famously one of the few in the series to make a loss, since the working class audiences did not take kindly to seeing themselves as the butt of the jokes in that one. Also not helped by the fact that it was advertised for a period before it came out as Carry On Comrade. Unlike the critics, I think the sketch or portmanteau format suits the series quite well. Literally nobody is watching one of these films for the plot. And Loving, to me, seems like a Rothwell rewrite of Regardless. It's like Carry On Regardless given the Rothwell treatment. That one has the greater sense of contemporary Britain in it for my money. You see snogging young couples blissfully unaware of the sexual repression of all these middle-aged men from the interwar period. There's even a black bus conductor, a super rare moment of diversity in one of these films. Abroad is the last film with pretty much every regular in it. And although it is particularly sleazy as an outing, the idea of the crew going on a seedy little holiday to a crap hotel in Al's Bells, and then literally nobody managing to get their leg over, despite palpable desperation on most of the male cast, is to me the absolute essence of what Carry On is all about. Much more than the period pieces, the costumes, and the famous lines. And finally, Girls is the first time that feminism overtly enters the picture through June Whitfield's puritanical, almost Mary Whitehouse-ish, Augusta Prodworthy, and her efforts to shut down a beauty contest. What I find interesting is that despite Rothwell's plainly reactionary sensibilities here, he sort of lets her win. It's almost like he knew what was coming. Let us end there, friends. This video can stand as a tribute to this series, which was as big a part of British culture growing up as watching football, fish and chips down the beach, Sunday roasts, and all the rest of it. Many a rainy Sunday, I remember, nothing else being on, sticking on one of these films. They are comforting in a way. It's that reassurance of familiarity and the coming to terms with the routine that I believe stands at the heart of vernacular, popular British culture. And I really hope that they do not become thought of as something to be ignored by the younger generations, or as an old person's thing, or as, I don't know, degenerate, or whatever it is that silly little Zoomers say these days. To me, these films form a living link to the past, so they should be remembered, they should be watched, they should be celebrated. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.